Tango Tango Papa 1912, June 8, 2015.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you from Warupa Valley, California. Otherwise known as Southern California. So, I was off for a few days. I had intended to do a podcast while I was at home, but didn't happen, obviously. My parents made it back from South Texas, and so they're around now for the duration of the summer. And so between having them there, along with I actually got a couple of things accomplished while I was at home. It's been a couple of years since I shampooed my carpet, so I went ahead and shampooed the carpet. Last time I did that, 2 years ago, as I recall, I also did a bunch of trimming work outside, and that's when I got the rather severe case of poison ivy. So I'm still very reluctant about touching green things. Any green leaves, any kind of green stuff, I don't touch it as a rule. But that doesn't stop me from mowing. I don't have a problem. I'm just allergic to poison ivy, so I stay. Obviously, I'm very careful about touching any kind of vines or. I know what poison ivy looks like. There's the old saying, leaves of three, leave it be. But I just play it safe, and I don't touch any kind of plant or vine. And that way I avoid problems. So I shampooed the carpet. Also, I mowed, obviously. Lawn hadn't grown quite as bad as I thought it would be. I thought it was going to be worse than what it was. And I think what happened, it rained so much while I was gone. There wasn't too much sun. Even though it rained a lot, there wasn't a whole lot of sun. And as a result, the grass just didn't have the opportunity to grow as much as it would have otherwise. With all of that water, had there been a more normal amount of sunshine. So, but anyway, I got the mowing accomplished. And another thing that I did while I was home, I repainted, I have some French doors, and I repainted the frame on the outside of those French doors, that faces outside. Paint was, I did that, I guess, probably a couple of years ago. The paint was starting to come off a little bit down towards the bottom, for whatever reason, about the bottom 6 inches. And it was time to fix that problem. And so the most time-consuming part of painting is masking the areas off that I didn't want to paint. But once I was able to, I did that with some tape, and once I was able to get those areas masked off, then it was a pretty simple matter of painting the wood that I wanted to paint, and the wooden frame, and so got that accomplished. And I also washed my back deck. So when I go home the next time, maybe I can wash the house. That needs to be done again. Might get my nephew to do it. I don't know, but if not, then I'm capable of doing it. Other things that I really need to get accomplished. I want to get accomplished maybe this summer. I need to replace the skirting around my house. It's a double wide mobile home, and the vinyl skirting that came with the home is kind of in bad shape at this point, and it needs to be replaced. And I was gonna do that a couple of years ago, actually, and I was gonna hire this guy to come do it for me, and he never did show up. He was gonna come look, and he never did show up. And I kind of got out of the mood, and I need to get that done. And the house, I've had the house now, it's hard to believe I've had it. I got the house in 1995, so it would have been late 95. So it's hard to believe I've had that house coming up on, I've had it at least 19 and a half years at this point, coming up on 20 years, because it was, I do remember it was kind of getting, it was towards, it was in the fall whenever I got the house, because I remember it was kind of cooler weather, as I recall. So, but once I replace the vinyl skirting again, this time I think I'll have better luck with it. And the stuff has lasted 20 years, so I can't. The stuff that I have already that's on there right now has lasted 20 years, even though it's not in the best of shape at this point. 20 years is pretty good. Now, the house has vinyl siding on it, and the vinyl siding is in pretty decent shape that's actually on the house. And it's always amazed me with vinyl siding. You can wash the thing with a mixture of Clorox. And there's other chemicals that you can buy. There's this, someone was telling me about this stuff called Jomax, J-O-M-A-X, that's good for mildew. And so I bought some of that at Home Depot. I bought a gallon of that, and a gallon is supposed to mix up about 20 gallons of solution that you can get rid of mildew with. And so the idea is you get it on there and let it soak a little bit, and then you just might have to scrub a little bit. Supposedly you don't with this Jomax product, but it's easy enough to do a little bit of scrubbing if I have to, and then you just spray it with clean water and wash it off. And it's always amazed me how nice it looks for a while until the mildew starts coming back. And it's another thing that's kind of interesting is how mildew always likes to really form on the north side of things. And it doesn't, it'll get on vinyl siding certainly, but it gets on other things too. It likes to form on the north side of trees. Other types of siding, such as wood siding, that's a painted surface, it doesn't discriminate. It forms on that as well. It could be metal siding. Any kind of thing that's facing the north, the mildew really likes the northern exposure for whatever reason. I'm sure it must have something to do with the sun. But but anyway, and then another thing I've thought about it for a while. You see these metal carports? And I thought for a while that I might, about getting one of those that I could park my pickup under. And just haven't done it. But may end up doing that. We'll see. I ended up talking to a I guess the guy's sort of a dealer, a local dealer, or he's at least displaying the stuff, and he's kind of acting as a salesperson for this company that installs these things. And so he gave me a brochure, and so I may go ahead and do that. They've got a rather wide variety of different types of metal carports. They've got a few different styles. They've got the ones that are single wide, then they've got some that are basically they're double wide for like two vehicles. That's probably the size that I would get. And then they also have full-blown metal buildings where you can it's basically it's a garage, metal building garage. Don't know if I really need that, but I probably just go for the carport. So I may do that, and I'd kind of like to do those things. And otherwise, the house is in pretty decent shape. I replaced the roof. I don't know. Probably, I can't remember now. It probably 4 or 5 years ago was when the roof was replaced. Maybe 5 years ago. And so the roof is, as far as I know, the roof's still in really good shape. And so once I replace the skirting, the house is really in pretty decent shape. Now, of course, houses, like anything else, and certainly houses, you have to do maintenance on them. And one thing I'll say about mobile homes may have some specific issues that you have to deal with, but overall, mobile homes, it's been my experience, mobile homes require less maintenance and less intensive maintenance than houses, conventionally built houses, can often end up being a problem. Now, on the other hand, a conventionally built house it's possible that those things can last longer as well. The mobile home that I have, I bought it new. It's been there for, it's, you know, almost 20 years at this point I've had it. And it's in pretty decent shape. I've had to replace some appliances. I've had some refrigerator problems. But the one that came with it, what was that? It was a General Electric. It had some problems after a few years. And then I went to, it was either Best Buy or Circuit City. I believe Circuit City. And I bought another refrigerator from there and had that for a few years. Ended up having some problems with it. And so then I switched to the one I have now. And I either bought it at Circuit City or Best Buy. I think I might have got it from Best Buy. And so this one that I have now, haven't had any trouble with it. So, but that's an appliance. And so those are not... appliances are appliances. I did also replace I've had to replace the furnace and the air conditioner. Of course, those things wear out. And I've had to replace, went ahead and replaced the hot water heater. I didn't have to. But the hot water heater that came in there was still working. But I went ahead and decided it would probably be a good idea to replace that. And so I replaced that, it's been less than a year ago, I guess. But otherwise, the only other appliances, I've got a cook stove, a gas cook stove, and that came with it, and that's working just fine. And then there's a dishwasher, and the dishwasher, continues to work just fine. I don't remember what brand it is, but continues to work just great. So, but there are always things that can go wrong with a house, and so you just have to expect and set aside money, time, and effort to you just have to realize that things are not going to stay perfect forever. There are always things that are going to wear out or go wrong or whatever, what have you. So, but anyway, came back to work, and then so I'm on a load. I picked a load up at Springfield, Missouri. Came back to work on the 5th, and then now the load that I have delivers on the 9th here in, or it delivers in Ontario. And so right now I'm probably, I don't know, the GPS says 6.6 miles from here to where I unload. Now, the straight line aside, it's actually more like 4.5 miles from where I unload, but just so happened I knew where I could park, saved the, you know, I've unloaded, and there's tons and tons and tons of warehouses in Southern California. There's just probably mile after mile after mile of them. And a lot of them, the side streets have truck parking, and so I had saved that into the GPS with the idea that if I ever needed to park, then I could easily just come and park. And so I'm glad that I did that, because I found a place to park. Otherwise, the place where I'm delivering the load to says they don't. They say they have no overnight parking, and so I, the other alternative would have been to go to the one of the two TA truck stops in Ontario. But they, the downside with those is that they charge $12 to park overnight, which is kind of, for 24 hours, which is kind of expensive. And so there's really no need for it. To park there and spend the $12 when I can just park on the street and it's perfectly safe. This is a industrial park type neighborhood, extremely quiet. There are a lot of other trucks that are parked along the street, and then you've got warehouses where trucks are unloading at, so it's a very nice industrial park type area. So, but the load delivers at 11 a.m. Tomorrow morning. So I have a piece of audio. I've got a Joel sent a piece of audio, and I haven't listened to it yet, so we're going to be listening to it together. And then I also have audio from a video that the New York Times put together. Occasionally they put together videos. They've been doing it for several years. They put these videos together. But in this case, this one is very interesting. It's about the back in the 1960s, there was this book. This professor, Paul Ehrlich, wrote this book called The Population Bomb. And of course, it was heavily promoted in the schools. I remember the Weekly Reader. If I don't know if they still have that around or not, but as a kid in school, I remember the Weekly Reader, and of course, they had articles in the Weekly Reader. They were pumping the propaganda even back then about how horrible this. There was this population, quote unquote, population bomb, and they'll talk about it's really surprising, because the New York Times has really kind of approached this in a surprisingly frank way. It's really I find it very interesting that they would admit something like this, because this kind of goes against what they seem to do otherwise, the things that they seem to promote otherwise. But the population bomb, it scared a lot of people into believing that it was a sort of like a doom and gloom. The world's coming to an end. We've got all these people that are reproducing. There's just too many people, and it's going to outstrip the Earth's ability to for human beings to grow enough food to feed all these extra human being mouths. And we're just it's the apocalypse. And billions of people are going to starve, and it's just going to be doom and gloom. And of course, it didn't happen. But it's interesting because I want to play this because it really demonstrates how suggestible people are, and how vulnerable society is, especially a society where the morals are kind of in trouble, have gone downhill, and they certainly had gone downhill in the 1960s, how suggestible people become because of that. Any meme, so-called meme or idea, can come along and just spread through the population, spread through people's minds like a virus, and many of those people will end up believing it. As I recall, to be perfectly honest, I kind of picked up at the time. I remember kind of picking up on the gloom and doom and how horrible it was, and we're all going to die, and who would want to bring kids into this world, and the whole you know, kind of the whole thing that the guy was trying to spread. I have to admit that I ended up kind of being infected by it. And in fact, I remember trying to infect other people with it. Trying to convince other people that, oh boy, this population is just going to, it's going to kill us all. We're all going to die. It's just going to be horrible. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play that, the audio for this video, be back afterwards.
Overpopulation, so long predicted, has stolen upon us. It's getting worse week by week.
In the 1960s, a new kind of fear began to spread across America.
The U.S. could be busting out at the seams by the end of this century.
If we do not, by humane means, limit our numbers, then numbers are going to be limited by more famines and shortages and consequent social conflicts.
The idea that human population was outstripping the Earth's ability to support mankind was a powerful one. And in the hands of one man,
population growth will kill you stone cold dead.
The message reached a wider audience than ever before. But what became of the population bomb?
How many years do you have to not have the world end to decide it didn't end because that reason was wrong?
Stanford biologist Paul Ehrlich didn't start out as a prophet of doom. His area of study focused on butterflies. But after visiting the crowded streets of Delhi, he had a realization.
If we continue to let population grow, and if we continue to exploit the underdeveloped countries, if we continue to pollute the seas with a wide variety of compounds and so on, it's very difficult for me to picture things holding together for more than another decade or so.
The basic point is so simple. We have a finite planet with finite resources, and in such a system, you can't have infinite population growth.
Ehrlich laid out his hypothesis in a slim volume called The Population Bomb. It was a call to action for many, including a student Ehrlich advised, Stuart Brand.
There's too many people, and we'd like to see people have fewer children and better ones.
The whole idea that people make more people who make more people until there's too many people, and by then it's too late, that's a very persuasive argument.
Adrienne Germain, a young women's health advocate, found herself drawn to Ehrlich as well, due to his support of birth control.
The message was that we were already in a crisis, and if we didn't have urgent and immediate action, the world would simply destroy itself.
Look at what the year 2000 will be. Our cities are going to be choked with people. They're going to be choked with traffic. They're going to be choked with crime. They're going to be choked with pollution. And they will be impossible places in which to live.
Paul's picture of doom and gloom looked real.
Net world population is increasing by 23 people every 10 seconds. It's clear that world population growth remains completely out of control.
I bought it totally. Many of my friends bought it totally. I organized an event for 60 people to starve in public.
What are you trying to prove?
It's about pain in the world. Maybe anybody who's thinking of having a third child ought to go hungry a week.
The mode became don't have kids. There's enough of them in the world. And if your friends have kids, it's fine if they feel uncomfortable about that.
We had formed an organization called Zero Population Growth. And then Johnny took me on The Tonight Show.
Would you welcome Dr. Paul Ehrlich?
You have to get the death rate and birth rate in balance. And there's only two ways to do it. One is to bring the birth rate down. The other is to push the death rate up.
I did the show maybe 20 times. And we went from 6 chapters and 600 members to 600 chapters and 60,000 members.
We're starting in now. This is the first step.
The Bagleys belong to a growing number of young marrieds who favor ZPG, zero population growth.
How many children do you have?
Two. I have two children.
Ehrlich's views on how to bring the birth rate down were concrete. Compulsion if voluntary methods fail. Creating a blacklist of people, companies, and organizations impeding population control in the U.S. Responsibility prizes for childless marriages. A tax on children, and a luxury tax on diapers and cribs.
The concerns about population became misanthropic, and it was taken with so much seriousness that Paul Ehrlich could recommend things like putting stuff in public water that would make people not as fertile.
Panic is not too strong a word to use for some of the advocates that I referred to as true believers.
It was a zeitgeist that was taking shape.
Attention, all citizens. Childbearing is herewith forbidden.
No! One of the things about zeitgeists is they have astonishing durability.
It appears that large families are on the way out, and ZPG may be possible.
The idea also took hold in the developing world, where governments like India's had already begun to embrace population control.
The core message of the book, population growth outstripping food supply, resonated quite a bit with India's elites, with the middle classes. They much preferred to believe that the poor were poor because of too many children, rather than being poor because of an unfair and unequal economic system.
If you start with that problem definition, then it's almost inevitable that there will be circumstances where governments and other actors will act in a way that is coercive.
In the mid-1970s, the Indian government began a controversial effort to encourage mass sterilization.
We do want to create an atmosphere in which people realize the importance of this program.
It led to abuses. Access to food aid and housing were sometimes used as coercion. Others weren't even given a choice.
More than 8 million sterilizations were performed, many forcibly. The people, in the words of one family planning expert, were treated like cattle.
Several days ago, crowds formed to protest being sterilized. The police opened fire and killed at least 50 of them.
Zero population growth is a tragic frame in the sense that it was assumed that there was no way out, that people would just go on reproducing until it really was a desperate circumstance in the world.
Ehrlich's message could be summed up in a dramatic prediction.
Sometime in the next 15 years, the end will come. And by the end, I mean an utter breakdown of the capacity of the planet to support humanity.
Predictions do not necessarily come true. The critics go in and look at these little stories that won't come true. And when they didn't come true, say, Ehrlich was wrong. I was recently criticized because I had said many years ago that I would bet that England wouldn't exist in the year 2000. Well, England did exist in the year 2000, but that was only 14 years ago.
But Ehrlich says it could still be just a matter of time.
One of the things that people don't understand is that timing to an ecologist is very, very different from timing to an average person.
How many years do you have to not have the world end to decide, whatever reason you thought the world was going to end, that actually maybe it didn't end because that reason was wrong?
Ehrlich predicted that by the 1970s, India would be starving. Quite to the contrary. The Green Revolution came to India with a big bang and a boom in such a rapid way that India has never looked back.
Although an estimated 3 million children around the world still die of malnutrition every year, the Green Revolution's farming technology helped lessen rates of hunger in the developing world over the decades, even as the world's population skyrocketed.
I know Paul Ehrlich reasonably well, and I respect him as a biologist. I don't, and never have, and he knows it, agreed with his views on population. There's a tendency to apply to human beings the same sort of models that may apply for the insect world. The difference, of course, is that human beings are conscious beings, and we do all kinds of things to change our destiny.
Paul Ehrlich saw a density of people that frightened him, but with time, we've been able to look past the car window into what's actually going on with the demographics of the people who live there, and they're not having so many kids. And that's changed the whole story.
That story is playing out today in parts of India. In growing cities like Chennai in the south, large families, once needed for farming, are no longer always seen as the key to success.
Previously, my father used to have 4 children, and my grandfather used to have 7 children. But the things have changed. Even myself, I have only 2 children. Even my sister is having only 1 kid, because now education becomes the first priority here.
Kamal Sharma takes time off from work to walk his 3 children home from school in the northern city of Patna, where he lives with his wife, Seema Devi. Devi made her own choice to limit her family size, unlike in the 1970s, when some people were forcibly sterilized. Although the national policy has changed, pressure to meet unofficial sterilization targets remains in many areas of the country, and sometimes turns sterilization surgery into a dangerous assembly line.
We are told that 83 women were operated upon in a span of just 6 hours by a single doctor.
But increasingly, the government is finding that fertility rates can be reduced in other ways. For example, a prioritization of maternal health in clinics like this one in Medavakkam has lowered infant mortality, making families more responsive to the government's message.
The population bomb was defused by urbanization, by people getting out of poverty all over the world, by having enough to eat so you didn't have multiple children in the hopes that some of them would survive. And it's somewhat ironic that what Paul Ehrlich saw as a horrible, hellish vision of the future is what turned the population bomb upside down.
Brand says that Ehrlich did succeed in raising awareness about important issues, such as the destructive effect population growth can have on the environment, even if some of his predictions didn't come to pass.
If you ask me the question, are there things that I have written in the past that I wouldn't write today? The answer is certainly yes. I've expressed more certainty because I was trying to bring people to get something done.
But his core message remains the same today. There are nearly 4 billion more people in the world, and they are consuming more resources than ever before.
I do not think my language is too apocalyptic in the population bomb. My language would be even more apocalyptic today. The idea that every woman should have as many babies as she wants is, to me, exactly the same kind of idea as everybody ought to be permitted to throw as much of their garbage into their neighbor's backyard as they want.
But if the world were to succeed in its decades-old task to curb population growth, what then?
What if large population is not bad, but is good?
What many more countries are already trying to come to terms with is aging of the population.
Japan needs more women to have children. The fertility rate's low. The population is getting older and shrinking.
America's in the midst of a baby bust.
China is hoping for a new baby boom.
While certain population hotspots remain a concern, largely in areas with the scarcest resources, much of the world is now grappling with the flip side of the population bomb.
The point at which population peaks around 9 billion in the 2040s or 50s, the story will not be, oh my God, we got 9 billion people. How horrible.
It'll be, oh my God, we're running out of people.
Okay, so there was the audio for the New York Times video taking a look at the population bomb book. And they had, they were interviewing Paul Ehrlich and then Stuart Brand. And then I forget the woman's name. I think they said it. And Stuart Brand and that woman had been followers, quote unquote, of, or almost disciples of Paul Ehrlich and his apocalyptic doomsday vision. And then Stuart Brand and then that woman, obviously, kind of woke up after the fact and realized, hey, this didn't happen. None of it happened. What's the deal? But of course, Paul Ehrlich is heavily invested in the book that he wrote and the subsequent popularity that he was able to achieve because Johnny Carson invited him on the Tonight Show 20 times. So he's heavily invested in that. And at this point, he can't really, some people have a terrible time coming out and saying, hey, I was wrong. It didn't happen. There's obviously something wrong with my ideas. I was wrong. He can't do that. So he's still, trying to, cling to his idea that there's too many people and at some point we're going to outstrip the humanity's going to outstrip the Earth's ability to sustain us, and so he still wants to believe that. Not going to happen. I think what is happening is that the population in a lot of countries that they mentioned, as they mentioned at the end, the population is declining for whatever reasons. And it's interesting because as prosperity sort of goes up, fertility kind of goes down. Generally speaking, people don't have as many kids. But if they're really super poor, then they have lots of kids. So the real cure for the problem is to raise everybody up. I want everyone in the world to be as prosperous as I am. I want everyone in the world, Africa, wherever, India, I want every single human being to have the opportunity to have as nice a life as I do. Now, that doesn't mean that they don't have to work, because I believe work is, it's really important that you work, and sometimes that means hard physical work. I've done that, been there, done that. There's nothing wrong with work at all, but, and in fact, work is good for you. If you have too much leisure, if your parents spoil you, then that creates its own problems. And we've got lots and lots of folks now that their parents spoiled them, the so-called millennials. There's tons of them that their parents spoiled them, and then now they're, I like to call them basement trolls. They're just back at home with mommy and daddy, and they've got their worthless college education. They were educated for jobs that don't exist, and they were maleducated. And so then they move back in with mommy and daddy, and mommy and daddy are kind of feeding them, and they're worthless human beings. They claim that they can't find work. There's plenty of jobs. Lots of jobs. I was reading on Mike Rowe, the guy that has done the dirty jobs, the TV host. He posts quite a bit on Facebook, and someone had criticized him. And so he posted a response, and in his response, he was saying that during all the time he's had these TV shows, even back at the height of the recession, there were the companies that he was dealing with had help wanted. They wanted to hire people, and they just can't find enough people to hire. And certainly that includes over-the-road truck drivers. There's always, no matter how bad at the height of the recession, it was still easy to get a job driving a truck over the road. And so the idea that there's too many people and you have too big of a population and there won't be enough jobs is nonsense. The bigger the population, the bigger your potential economy is. And you want people, the more people you have producing goods and services, the bigger the economy gets, the bigger the pie gets, and then everybody is able to benefit. Because the more people that are producing goods and services, the or the better the overall standard of living is able to become. So the idea that you're going to have a bunch of idle people doing nothing is generally that's bad. You want people working. You want people producing things. So spoiling your kids is if you're going to have kids, and you know, I don't have any kids, never have had any kids, never will have, but if you're going to have kids, this is my opinion, then the worst possible thing you can do is spoil them. You spoil them, you ruin them. So that's, you want to teach them to work, to do, find something that's useful. Because if you can, the idea that, well, like, you know, there's not enough jobs or whatever, is nonsense. Find something useful to do. And I contend that you can almost always find something useful to do. Now, but the problem is with these basement trolls, is that because they've got their they've been educated, and even though their education is worthless, they were miseducated, and then they've got these giant government student loans that they can't pay back, so they're sort of beholden to the big government. The idea of government is going to, you know, has got this sword of Damocles kind of hanging over their necks. They feel that these jobs, oh, those jobs are beneath them. They can't drive a truck. Oh, that's beneath me. I can't do that. Or I can't do any kind of a job where I might get my hands dirty because that's beneath me. Well, sorry. So, anyway, I thought that was interesting. But what I take away from that is how easy it is for these ideas to be injected into your mind. And it can come through the schools, certainly, but a lot of these ideas come through popular culture, so-called popular culture. Johnny Carson back in the day was a popular culture. Whatever he decided to allow on his show, and he brought them on, he was essentially promoting it. and allowing his show as sort of a promotional vehicle. So, but that idea caught on, and a lot of people believed it. And people want, people also, the other part of it, people have a need to believe in an apocalypse. Because people that have lost their morals must idolize something. They have to be idolaters. And idolatry requires demons. So you have whatever it is you're idolizing. Let's say it's Apple. I love picking on Apple and the Apple people. You're idolizing your Apple products, and you have to have a demon. The Apple. If you idolize Apple, then the demon, it used to be Microsoft, and now the demon is Android. And the demon is Google, and the demon is Samsung. If you idolize Harley Davidson, then the demon is Honda. Or if you idolize Chevrolet, then the demon is Ford. Or if you idolize Ford, then the demon is Chevrolet. The list goes on and on and on. So, but anyway, just as I say, what I take away from that is how easily these ideas are picked up on. And don't just accept things because someone, you know, Paul Ehrlich was presented as an expert. He's an expert from, what do they say, Stanford. He's a professor. He must be an expert. He sounds authoritative. And he's got a book published. Somehow there's always magic if something is in print. It's really a strange kind of a phenomena, but people see their name, something in print, and so therefore it must be true. It's kind of like if you see it on television, it must be true. It's really an interesting phenomena. Somehow those things, or even the New York Times, the New York Times itself, just those four words, gives things an air of legitimacy. It's really a really interesting phenomenon how that works. So, anyway, now I want to go ahead and play Joel's comment. As I said, I haven't listened to it at all, but so we're going to be listening to it together. So here is Joel.
Hey, Tom. This is Joel McLaughlin again. Just wanted to have some comments about your last show. I do appreciate when you do a podcast, because I just don't have the time. I always have the time to watch your YouTube videos. Even though they are mercifully short for the most part, which is a good thing, I might start watching some of those. But I'm kind of with you on the podcast where, you know, for me, I want to podcast when I want to. I'm not going to feel beholden to a schedule. In fact, it's probably been over a year since I posted a podcast at this point. You know, I already podcast with my friends once a week, and it's a group podcast. It's more or less a bunch of friends getting together in a mumble chat room and talking about different various things that technology people care about. So there are lots of things with this regard, you know, within podcasting that just, you know, my podcast, I originally started it to talk about life in Ohio, You know, and a lot of people would say, well, Ohio's boring. Well, to me, it's the least boringest place there is, because one, because I live here, and two, a lot of people just don't think of all the other things there are to do here other than go to Cedar Point or to Kings Island, or used to go to SeaWorld over in Aurora, you know. So, but there's so much more, you know. Every summer in Chillicothe, there is a play called Tecumseh. It's done outdoors, and it is basically about the life of Tecumseh. Then there's all kinds of other stuff, but that's kind of what it started out to be. And the thing is as my life has changed since I started the show, I just don't have the time to go do things. So it's more involved into me just ruminating and telling stories of my life and things I've done around the state, you know, as well as just my life, you know. And there's times I just don't feel like sharing things. So
allow me to interrupt. You said something interesting, and I think I'm detecting this not only within myself, but in other people that podcasted or were early podcasters, and people on the internet in general. And I've thought about this for a while. You're saying you just don't feel like sharing things, and at one time, it was, you go back a few years ago in the podcast, especially when I was doing it every day, day in and day out, I was sharing most everything. And at this point, the motivation, for whatever reason, the motivation to just talk about every little aspect of what goes on with my existence from one minute to the next, I don't feel the motivation to share it. And so there, that, and I don't know, there's some good reasons not to, actually. Because if one of the things I've noticed is that especially now, it's always kind of been true that you could have, once the internet came along, you would have things that, you know, somebody would say something or do something and it would kind of blow up, and you'd have a bunch of people that would publicly ridicule them. And now it's gotten to the point where that's happening almost, if you really follow it, it's happening almost on a daily basis, where someone will say something, and then it, oftentimes now it's happening on Facebook. There was a, this podcast that I listened to recently, and I don't think I mentioned it here in my podcast, but there was this podcast I listened to, and they were talking about, there was, and now I don't remember the gal's name, but she had posted some pictures. Her and a friend were in Washington, D.C., and they had a camera. They had their camera, and they were doing the tourist thing, I guess. But in any case, she thought it would be funny, and, you know, it's kind of stupid, really, on her part, but she thought it would be funny if at these different memorials, the tourist memorials, like the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and the different ones, if she made these really irreverent gestures, so you can just imagine that she's giving the, whatever it is, the monument of the middle finger or whatever. And then her friend took the picture, and so she posted a number of these pictures on her Facebook page. And so nothing happened for a couple of days, and then all of a sudden somebody picked up on it, and it really started to go viral, and then she even got to the point where she was receiving death threats. Now, she should have known better than to do something. You don't do anything like that. If you've got any common sense, the common sense is going to tell you don't do something like that to start with. But you don't even do it in jest. There are some things that you just don't even make a joke out of. But certainly that is one of them. But nonetheless, it created quite a problem for her, and she ended up getting fired from her job. And she had to move back in with her parents for a while. And so that's just one example. Now, there are other examples where people, you just have normal people saying things, just the normal stuff now. It doesn't have to be that extreme. It could be something like you criticizing abortion, for example. Or it could be something as simple as expressing a positive Christian value. And all of a sudden someone comes along and makes a big deal out of it. And then they have all their minions come along, and it's kind of like locusts. And that can really create problems. So, do you really need that? Is it, what good does it do to if you get what benefit is it if you get caught up in something like that? It isn't. Because you're not going to, for the most part, you're not going to change the minds of the people, the so-called trolls. You're not going to change their minds. They're looking for whatever they can to destroy, to ridicule, to publicly ridicule. So there's some good reasons why you might want to back off from sharing certain types of things, for the simple reason that at this point our society is really out of control. Especially, you know, with all these basement trolls. They don't work. There's someone supporting them. They have nothing better to do than just hang out online and tear things down if they can. So, as I say, at this point, do I really want to share my opinion about things? And what good does it do? At what point is it possible to share too much? And then the other part of that is that after you've spent a long time doing, let's say, a podcast, at what point do you finally get to where you feel like you're beating your head against the wall, or you're just ready to move on and do something different? But I look at it really more in terms of motivation. And there are, for a long time, I was really feeling motivated to write articles about technology and that kind of thing. And at this point, not so much. So my motivation has changed. Now, I don't know, that could be because of my age. Maybe I don't have as, you know, let's face it, I might not have as much energy as I once had. I am staying pretty busy with work. And, but even like today, I had ended up really sitting all day because the load doesn't deliver until tomorrow. So I sat most of the day at Barstow and I decided, well, I could do a podcast today. And then I finally decided to do it. But it would have been easy to, I could have just as easily said, well, don't really feel like it. I'm not going to do it. And I'm kind of getting that way with the videos. For a while, it was easy. I was going ahead and putting a video up like every day. And at this point, I'm not doing that. I'm still putting some videos up, but I'm not really getting much out of it. The main reason that I like doing the podcast, even though I'm doing it a lot less frequently, is that I use the podcast as a, especially talking about these issues, I use it as a more, I don't really care how many people are listening, and I never really have, but, and of course it's nice to have interaction with people, but on the other hand, I use this as a means to sort of flesh out my own ideas, and inevitably the process of thinking about these things and talking, and certainly talking about these ideas, inevitably causes me to think of other things, and so there's, and see things in different ways, and so it's an ongoing process. And so as long as I, that's been my main motivator, really, especially in recent years. I get a lot out of it myself, just the process of putting it together and doing it. I've really benefited from it, whether anyone else has or not, or maybe, but I've certainly absolutely benefited from it. So, but I'll continue to do it, but don't, as I say, don't expect it to be very frequent, because it's all about motivation, and if I don't feel motivated, I can't do it. I can't force myself to do things that I don't really feel motivated to do. So, but anyway, I find it interesting because there's a number of people, and I've read some articles that where people have been bloggers and they've really kind of backed off from. Doing nearly as much as they once did online. They've become a lot more private, whereas at one time they were super public. So I think that may be kind of a natural, there may be sort of a natural process or a natural kind of a timeline that people go through if they're sharing at some point. They may naturally decide for whatever reason that it's time to become more private again. So anyway, it's an interesting thing, and I've noticed it not only with myself, but I have noticed it with other people. And there are articles about people that I've seen that people are specifically, they've just stopped sharing so much. And so there, it's an interesting question. Should at this point, is it should you continue to just be, you know, post everything on Facebook and just be super sort of super transparent about everything and post every little thing about your life, your existence, or not? And I'm thinking no. Be very selective about it.
That's why I haven't podcasted a lot, because I've been so busy with the new job you know, where, you know, I work out of the house, and a lot of people think that, oh my gosh, that, you know, that'd be so awesome. You know, well, it's not, you know, because you never get a break from your office. You know, like a good example here is I have some things I have to do for a client every Thursday night at 6 o'clock at night. So I can't ignore those things, you know. So I have to do those things. And those are the things that I absolutely positively have to do. And sometimes it means I have to put in an extra 2.5 hours after, you know, an hour and a half after I quit for the day at 5, which is my normal quitting time. And then sometimes I have to work weekends even. And depending on the client, you know, if I can help them out, I will help them out, even if I'm not working. Case in point, they had a new client that I did an install for last year in Kentucky. And I saw an email from them. They had another install done by another consultant. I knew exactly what the issue was. I had ran into it before with another client, so I helped them out. You know, it only took me about 15 minutes, but you know, those 10 things tend to eat in time. And it used to be some of the extra time that I would do the podcast in. And then other times it was just, you know, I get down, I sit in front of a computer every day, don't really want to fire up the computer and record, don't even want to go for a walk and record. And when I do record mobily, I have to bring it back and edit it. It's just a pain. So I just, it's not something, you know, I'll do it. I don't mind doing it. It's just that, you know, if I have other things that are better to do, that's what I'm going to do. You know, another thing is that I got back into ham radio pretty heavily. So some of the things that with, when I would normally do podcasting, I'd rather talk on the radio. So that's kind of my thing on podcasting. You know, I'll never shut it down because my hosting is dirt cheap. Don't really care. You know, 5 years from now, if somebody downloads a podcast from 5 years ago, I don't care. They can listen to that. You know, so, you know, that's kind of my feeling. I'll always keep it there until I'm absolutely positively done with it. So I guess if I go a couple years paying for the hosting and not posting, then maybe I'll probably shut it down. But for now, I'll continue it. In regards to idolization, you know, you hit the nail on the head. People idolize things. Their phones, their watch, their car, their favorite football team, football in general. And in those, you know, in all those cases, idolization, it's not necessarily something that takes you from your religion, because your religion can take you away from God, believe it or not. Ministry can take you away from God. Ministry can end up becoming to be more about you than it is about God. In that case, it's an idol. You know, and to me, idolization is putting anything else, including ministry, you know, your church before God. And that's the problem.
Okay, well, thank you, Joel. The idolization is everywhere. And what, you know, it's one of those things. There's a dictionary, really a dictionary definition of it, certainly. And when, as I've said before, when you say idolization, it's easy to get the impression that you've got the golden calf, and you put it in the corner, like the ancient Israelites when they were idolizing. You've got the, you know, and you actually have something physical that you put in the corner that you're worshiping, and it can be that, or it could be a statue that you're worshiping. But generally speaking, if you can really grasp the concept and understand what it is, and go back really to the Adam and Eve story, and man wanted to play God, to be his own God, and we do that in our minds. We can use physical objects, but the physical objects, obviously, it's happening. The problem is happening in our minds, and our minds are kind, in a sense, if you understand how the brain works, our minds are almost like a simulation, or our minds are simulating. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. Our brains sort of simulate representations of the outside world. And because the brain itself is in the dark, and it's encased by bone, and the only thing that's coming in is information from the outside world. So you have visual information, you have auditory information, you have smell, you got the five senses coming in, you got that information coming in, and somehow the brain is able to take that information and make sense of the outside world. But it's in a large sense, it's simulating it. And it may do a very accurate job, but it can do a very accurate job of simulating the outside world, but nonetheless, it's a simulation. So, but as human beings, there are plenty of people that want to believe that we're just animals, we're just, somehow we're just these really intelligent apes. And by the way, we do have ape bodies. There are some types of chimpanzees. If you test their DNA versus human DNA, and there's just a couple of percentage points difference in the DNA. So the DNA is our DNA in some cases is very similar to ape DNA. To chimpanzee DNA. But there's something that sets us apart. And it's more than just having a bigger brain and somehow we're more intelligent. It's more than that. We're aware of our own existence. But beyond that, there's something. If you have a chimpanzee, the chimpanzee cannot be anything other than a chimpanzee. So they got their chimpanzee behavior. They groom each, you know, you have different types of apes that groom each other. They spend a great deal of time kind of grooming each other and eating and beating their chest or whatever it is that they, the different versions of the apes do. And they sleep, and they may have a group of they're called troops, but they're a group of about different, depending on the species, there's about 50 in the group. And they may fight for their territory and the typical things. You've seen the shows, I'm sure. But a chimpanzee or any other kind of ape has no conflict. They have no conflict going on in their they're aware of their environment. They're aware of each other. They're aware of human beings. But they have no conflict. There is no conflict. They are what they are. They cannot be anything else. They're driven by their instincts. They're able to respond to their environment. Human beings have this other thing, this kind of this sense of right and wrong. And there's a, for lack of a better word, there's a spirit. There's actually a couple of spirits that are actually talking to us constantly. Maybe not so much in the form of words, but there's this constant sort of a tug of war going on. If you kind of look at the human brain as a radio receiver, there's two channels that you can tune into. Think of the Jiminy Cricket thing on one side telling you the right thing to do, and then the guy with the pointed horns and the red jumpsuit and the pitchfork with the sulfur on the other shoulder, you know, kind of urging you to do the wrong thing. You can think of it that way. But there really are two forces that weigh on us as human beings when we come into this world. We come into this existence. But we have this proclivity as human beings to want to play God in our own minds. And it's just... it has to do with the nature of really of our consciousness. And some of these things you have to understand. You have to come to an understanding of these concepts yourself. And some of these things, they cannot be put into words. It's not possible to adequately put these concepts into words. But suffice it to say, if you play God in your own mind, you have to idolize. You end up idolizing the wrong things. You idolize, it could be anything and everything. Because in order to play God in your own mind, you have to have false idols. But the interesting thing is that you can twist things in your own mind. You can twist it using kind of words. You can sort of twist things so that you're really not doing what you're doing. You're really not idolizing. You can make it seem in your own mind that you're perfectly innocent. It's just a perfectly innocent thing to do. I'm going to church and I'm doing all of the things and giving money to the church, for example. And you're creating a false idol with the church. And you've got the you idolize the Bible and you worship. You're basically worshiping the book. And it's possible to turn that into something that it... into a false idol. And different brands of religion, different false idols. Let's say you're just to pick something, you know, pick on a particular religion. Let's say that you're any of them. I feel kind of reluctant to do it, but let's say that you're a Church of Christ. And you're really into the Church of Christ, that's the one you idolize. You idolize the Church of Christ, and you really believe that that's the right way, and so on and so forth. But then you've got a demon. What's the demon? Other religions, particularly the Catholic Church. Oh, that's the demon. So when you have a false idol, and you always use this as a rule of thumb. If you've got something, person, place, or thing that you feel that you just have to demonize, then you've got false idol. That's almost like a false idol detector. Because if there's something person, people, places, or things that you feel that you just have to demonize, these are bad. Like Android is bad, and Google is bad, and Samsung is the devil. That's a good indication. That's a false idol detector. You know that you're probably worshiping Apple, and you may not even think that you are. You think, oh, I just love technology, and my iPhone is so pretty, and I love the way it's shaped, and it's just such a pretty device. Or it could be your car. Or it could be your football, pick your football team or whatever your favorite team is. And by the way, you got your favorite team, and then you always, whatever your team is, then there's always demon teams. So I'm not into sports at all, so I don't know which ones are which, but there are always demon teams. And they come up with cute little names. Oh, well, there's a rivalry. There's a football rivalry between this group or this football team and some other football. Oh, there's a rivalry. You have people worshiping their false idols, and then they demonize. They've got this other thing that's the demon. And so, as I say, it's really difficult to put this into words. And I'd say it's almost, it's virtually impossible to explain this to someone and have them be able to understand it. Because at some point, you have to, in order to really understand this and understand how it works, kind of the mechanics of it, first of all, you have to want to understand it. And then secondly, you really have to understand it for yourself, and there's no way around it. You can listen to me talk about it, and maybe do a really poor job of talking about it, but ultimately you've got to understand what it is, what idolization is yourself, and then if you can understand that, then it's easy to spot. But it's everywhere. It really is everywhere. And so mention it again. If you go to my website, truckertompodcast.com, up at the top, there's a link that says meditation. Click on that link. And that will, I've got about 4 files that are hosted on my site. And you could download those, play them on your, whatever your device, burn them to CD, however you want to do it. Those will teach you a very simple meditation technique. And the idea is of that meditation technique is to, you practice that, and that it's basically, it's a way of being still, and it's a way of bringing your point of awareness, because we as human beings have this point of awareness, bring that out of your thoughts. And so therefore it's possible, it is absolutely possible to be aware but not caught up in thought, because it's easy for us to think that we are our thoughts. We are not our thoughts. We end up caught up in our thoughts. But the meditation, if you learn how to do it properly, then you will realize that we as human beings, this point of awareness that we have, that is not our thought. It's possible to be aware but not caught up in thought. Be in the moment. And in this state of awareness and being in the moment, that's where God is. That's where your Creator is. And that is in that state, practice being in that state, in the moment, then you allow your Creator to catch up with you instead of constantly running away into all of these distractions. And that's basically, in a sense, that's what idolization is. It's a way of distracting yourself. It's a way of being distracted away from your Creator. Because then you can get away. The idea is you get away from your Creator. You can be your own God and make your own. You can create your own God. In other words, you got your false idol. But of course, the false idols can't really save you. The false idols may seem like. Somehow that may seem like that somehow that makes you great, that you're a better person because you like Apple. And of course, that's the other part of it. You have pride in whatever it is that you've turned into the false idol. You know, even to the point where you have pride marches, you kill your baby pride marches, abortion pride march, for example, or you have labor pride marches. Because you're all pissed off because you have to work, and so you get this other group of people that you get together with, and you have a pride march, and there's other types of pride marches. Same principle applies, kind of externalized people, that filled with rage, filled with resentment. So. The idea is that if you practice being still, you practice allowing reality to catch up with you. Just hold still and allow it to catch up with you. Make friends with it. And once that guides you, once that becomes your guiding spirit, it's possible to still live your life. It's possible to still interact with the world, interact with other people. But if you've got the right guiding spirit, it's sort of like you can be in the world, but not of it. It's actually a very simple thing. So that's on my website. Give it a try. I can't promise it'll help everybody. I do believe that it will help most people. But it's up to you to continue with it. Can't do it just once and that's it. It doesn't work that way. It's necessary for you to have the motivation. So, anyhow, probably better be bringing this to a close. I've got to, as I say, the load delivers tomorrow morning at 11, so I'm just a few miles away from where the load delivers, so I'll, as I said before earlier, I will try to get there by about 10 to 10:30, and then we'll see what they're able to come up with after the load is unloaded. So, anyhow, hope everyone is having a great week so far, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.